Good morning. Welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom. It is June the 5th, and I'm Celia Farber. My co-host, Christina Borgeson, is on assignment. She'll be back next week. And I am truly excited to speak to our very special guest today. His name is Dennis Speed. I've known Dennis since this past winter, and we've become good friends, and he's one of my favorite people to talk to. Dennis has been associated with politics in New York City since 1977. That is 43 years. He is a writer for Executive Intelligence Review magazine, which was founded in 1974. By economist Lyndon LaRouche. I know that name sets off a lot of a storm of associations, and I hope we'll have time to clarify some of them, at least, with our guest. So since 2014, Dennis has also co-headed the Manhattan Project, which is an initiative that was proposed by Lyndon LaRouche, who passed away in 2019. And Dennis is also the Northeast coordinator for the Schiller Institute, named after the German poet and philosopher Friedrich Schiller. Dennis, welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom.
Yep, glad to be here.
So we're going to jump right in. We had a little pre-talk this morning, and I told you that I am feeling so confused, sad, disoriented, broken. And I said, my first thought when I was thinking about this, where to begin, I was thinking, well, I want to ask Dennis how he's feeling about this whole situation. Not to start with your extraordinary, what your brain is producing on this, because I know it's producing a lot, and I'm really, really interested in what you and your circle have been saying and what you are saying now. I know that you're very sophisticated about global economic, like what's going on beneath the ostensible surfaces of everything. But this morning when we spoke, we talked a little bit about the word tragedy. So let's just start there, which I think fits with my instinct to begin to talk about how we feel about what's going on and then work our way toward what we think is going on. Dennis,
I'm really glad you put it that way. And because that actually allows me to say a little bit about why I would be involved with something called the Schiller Institute. You know, he's known as a poet. A lot of people know his name because of the Ode to Joy, which is the thing that Beethoven wrote the Ninth Symphony to, famous. But he mainly wrote tragedies. If you look at his body of work, there are plays that he wrote which were about pretty much, well, many of the nations of Europe, of course, which because he's from Germany, and he wrote his play Wallenstein, three parts about Germany, and there's William Tell, famous, about Switzerland, and there's The Maid of Orleans about Joan of Arc in France, and there's, you know, play about Italy, there are plays about other locations, and he died at the age of 44, so there's stuff that he didn't have a chance to write about, but there are usually tragedies. And what he wrote an essay once about this, about the idea of the theater considered as a moral institution. And what he was trying to get at here was that there are great crimes that get committed in the world, and there is no elegant solution. There is no redress of grievances. there is a cry for justice, but it goes unheard. And that the purpose of the theater was to, as a moral institution, that is, was to bring a lot of these matters into a setting where people could get behind the actions of the tragic characters, that they could be allowed to see the forces that are brought to bear, and to understand that actually tragedy is not necessarily what a lot of us were taught, at least not maybe everybody, that there's a tragic flaw in somebody. And because they are tragically flawed, they do something. They commit a crime. They misunderstand an important circumstance. You know, like, for example, Othello, for example, has this is or in the case of the eponymous play by Shakespeare. That's not really how it works. Tragedy is actually occurs because an individual who is not characterized by the problems of their society fails to rise above the problem. They hesitate. They decide to act just the exact same way everybody else is acting. And
wow.
Yeah. And that's the way that, so the reason I think it's important is if you look at what's going on right now, let's just take America and the streets of America, which is only one circumstance and many other circumstances. If you looked at Brazil, you'd see something that would be reminiscent of the United States, but it's very different. Or other cases. But let's just take what happened around the George Floyd.
Right.
And you see the demonstrations, and then you see the process which has of manipulation and looting and so on, which did occur and does occur at nights. And then you see the police reactions, and then you see people's reaction to the police reactions, and then you hear people talk about how the only reason that this is even an issue is because there was violence in order to make the point that an action had to be taken to bring the police to justice. You watch this. Then you have the people that talk about 50 years ago. They talk about the riots of the 1960s. Some people call them the urban rebellions of the 1960s. And everybody begins to intone something, some statement, some perception, some platitude in some cases. Then some really heartfelt, deeply felt outrage at what was clearly a murder, which is videoed. But you have the sense, as you hear this, and as you even hear yourself speak on some occasions, as though you're going lockstep, virtually, towards some doom, that there's no concept, and I'm not saying this is a necessary situation, I'm not saying that, but you get the sense that there's a recurrence of a principle of tragedy because somehow no one has yet stated something above the circumstance that at the same time resonates with the circumstance and internal to the circumstance.
Wow.
You feel the need. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Dennis, I'm just going to pause you for a second because what you just said, I just want that to resonate. What you just said, that is it. Nobody had put it into words. You just did. It's like being trapped under an overturned boat or something, and we cannot rise above. I don't mean rise above the human and be saints. I mean rise above this cacophony of lockstep presumptions, accusations, and moral playwriting that is stuck under this boat because its conclusions are foregone.
That's right.
Conclusions are foregone. So everything we are permitted to hear, think, absorb, at least in the so-called public realm, social media realm, has that quality of foregone conclusions that we may partake in if we wish to be part of this society in this time.
That's the framework that one has to choose to reject. And that's very difficult because you have the inertia, if you want to put it that way, the pull downward, sort of like in Edgar Poe's A Descent into the Maelstrom, where you're in, you know, you find yourself thrust into the middle of a whirlpool, and the whirlpool's got its own, you know, logic, it's got its own motion, and you're in a ship which is now spinning around, you know, almost at right angles, in the sky, in the water, and you can see down to the bottom. So you know how this is likely to end, and you've got to figure out some way, some principle by which you can understand what's happening to you and thereby save your life. And I think that's where we are. So you ask what I'm feeling and what the circumstances I think we're in. And that's why I responded that way.
Well, I wonder if we could. I tend to avoid the subject, but I just want to put out the name, the name around which the permitted thought all revolves, Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. When you, maybe I'm making a presumption, but I'm presuming that discussions around him, character, motive, what he stands for, what he's doing, what he's done, what he plans to do, good, evil, et cetera, has been something that's come up a lot in conversation in your life. Am I right so far? I mean, that's what he does, or that name. Now, he doesn't do this, but the syndrome about him, the mass hysteria about him causes that part
right.
to be an inevitability for all of our lives. Do you believe that he has the dark intention and power that's generally attributed to him?
I think that the whole discussion from really when it began in 2016, ostensibly around the personage of Donald Trump, is exactly, it's very interesting how this conversation is going, because this is exactly an expression of this misplaced notion of tragedy taught for so many decades in the American school system. So, for example, see, you're supposed to, if you are said to be a political person, or even for that matter, just a conscientious person, you're supposed to take a position about Donald Trump, whatever it is. You know, sort of like the Facebook thing with the thumbs up and thumbs down, right? Yeah, like it doesn't matter what's going on or in the world, right? It can be many things. It could be arms control. It can be famine. It can be a new technological invention or something. Whatever. At some point in whatever conversation you're having with anybody, you got to take a position. And I notice mm-hmm. I'm using that word. I know I can say the word. I can say position, but I'm saying it the way it's positioned, right? But Donald Trump.
Yeah.
How did the world, right? Get to be like that, you know, after no matter, despite the number of whatever existentialist novels you've read, histories you've read on, you know, World War One by Barbara Tuchman or other kinds of things that you have engaged in your life. The fact that you may have just reread, you know, something like the Commedia of Dante, or maybe you saw Blazing Saddles last night. No matter whatever it is, it's going to all spiral back to Trump. Now, I said all that to get to this point. There's something called the American presidency. It is not the same as the American president. The American president is an occupant of the office, but the executive office of the presidency involves tens of thousands of persons. And people sort of think about it in terms of the cabinet of the presidency. But of course, remember, one of the departments of the presidency is the Department of Defense. And although, of course, obviously, that department has within it many different layers. Donald Trump said something the second day he came into office. He said, I intend to basically take apart, when I take apart, he said a challenge to take apart the 16 intelligence agencies. Well, it was actually 17, but he said 16. And then about 6 days after that, Chuck Schumer said, these agencies have six ways to Sunday to take you out. And what happened, we watched the process unfold, which in the Executive Intelligence Review, we've written many things about. And we watched the process unfold in which McCarthyism was resurrected as something called Russiagate. And persons who really went through McCarthyism recognized it, but because of their, in many cases, their visceral response or reaction to Donald Trump, they would suppress their reaction in which they were hearing all these things about Russia, even, by the way, up until yesterday. Various people, I think including Susan Rice, were talking about how Russia was responsible for the riots. So normally intelligent people, in fact, they are intelligent people, would nonetheless find themselves repeating things and justifying something that they know they went through in the 1950s and there was nothing to it, just like there's nothing to Russiagate at all. There's no content. Kind of like, anyway, so that's only one. Now there's China. Got the same process going on around China. China can be, and of course this one involves a slightly different political demographic, right? Because this involves a lot of the people that are so-called right-wing and clearly have, shall we say, a problem with the yellow peril. Let's just put it like that, okay? And so they got a whole thing that China somehow exported the coronavirus to America and other places to take over their economy. So they got that narrative, okay? And now, again, Trump has weighed in on this. Okay, and now you're supposed to take a position about Trump's relationship to Xi Jinping, Trump's relationship to Vladimir Putin, da-da-da. But then you realize that what has happened to your mind? Your mind has now gone from being able to once contemplate how a several trillions dollar out-of-control defense establishment romping all over the world in 80 or so different countries with 800 plus military bases, depending on who you listen to, it's 1,000, globally extended, but with a special relationship to the City of London financial circle, which is sort of the Carlet to Wall Street, and with a special relationship to what's called the Five Eyes, or the United States being one, and there's Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the United Kingdom, as it's called. You have a globalized surveillance that's going on, and despite the best efforts of whether it's Snowden, whether it's Assange, or whether it's Lyndon LaRouche, for that matter, and his organization, people like Bill Binney, former, I've talked your show, it's called The Whistleblower, so national security agent for 30 years, who is now one of the leading opponents of what people often call the deep state. I simply call it, the shallow empire, financial empire, which is largely based in London, as well as the United States in Wall Street and also offshore. So there's this broader, as you said, when we began, we were talking actually earlier about this impending sort of monster, this lurking force behind the scenes that is causing people to flow, the history to flow in a certain direction. And I'm supposed to, take Trump and make Trump the center of that. Now, here's the problem doing it. Donald Trump is the president of the United States, and he is capable, particularly because what he has said about what he wanted to do with Xi Jinping, what he said about what he did, what he wanted to do with Vladimir Putin in terms of the issue of war as well as trade. But remember that Trump's campaign pledge, and we have to admit, while there have been police actions, while there have been a lot of some things which are pretty dirty that have happened, the United States is not in a war. We had that with Obama. We had it with Bush 43. We had it with Bush 41. We had it, of course, with Clinton. We haven't had it with Trump. So you look at the situation and you look at the focus you're supposed to have and how you're supposed to take these positions, and you realize there's something else right now that we have to consider. What if what is happening is that the institution of the presidency, which has been being undermined for many years, obviously, you can go back to the time of Kennedy for that, 63. But what if the institution of the presidency is going to disappear or dissolve or be dissolved by financial forces, much, much more powerful than nations? Globally extended financial forces want to create a circumstance where the American, whether military capability or other capabilities, are caused to self-destruct as they pursue this sort of policy of creating a depopulated, increasingly depopulated, but a governable world that returns us to a kind of feudalism. A time where there's 5% of the population that are educated to do anything. 95% of the people are reduced to a status of peons, of peasants, and there's a lot less of them. What if that's what we're looking at, and that the focus on Trump takes the focus away from what we're supposed to be doing individually to address this broader, if you will, not invisible, because I don't think it's invisible, but this broader military, monetary, financial complex that has to be taken on by us now taking awareness or becoming aware and taking the issue of injustice and reversing it and by various means. I don't happen to think they need to be violent. What if that's what this is all about?
We've had Mr. Binney on our show. Needless to say, I admire him enormously. And that was where you and I met, where you held the forum with Binney and friends, and it was fascinating. Several hours. Actually, I recorded a lot of it. And let me ask you this, just as an aside. Could you tell us is the recording of that evening is that available online somewhere?
You know, that's an interesting question. I have to check that. I believe so. But I have to check to really know. There was recorded, that's for sure, and it may be that it was kept in a private channel at that point, but I'm not certain about that. I would check.
Okay.
That.
Okay.
I'll get it for you in any case. Yeah.
Well, the one of the things you were interested in that in our discussions that I had said to you probably via email is I had said, just trying to, you know, demonstrate share with you some of what's coming up for me in all of this. I'm somebody who has chronicled the persecution of particularly scientists for the last, since the era of AIDS, who went against dominant, I would say, globalist thinking on what appear to be scientific posits, scientific paradigms. But I'm realizing more and more how virus, in quotes, a virus, viruses mm-hmm. are used, mm-hmm. they're used as proxies. It's like economic and sociological weaponry. And those scientists who remained classical, classically trained, with classical values about the scientific method, they became the despised, persecuted, detested new underclass in the 80s, most notably Professor Peter Duisberg. Mm-hmm. Dr. Andrew Wakefield is another one. Bill Binney is another one. I just stepped out of the viral war right there when I said Bill Binney. But there, everybody who speaks as an individual, well, of course, Bill Binney is a man of science, so he's speaking forensically always to what he knows to be true. The people who are in power, both in the big picture and in all of our social circles, are the ones who avoid specifics and forensics and what people like to call science, and instead go with this mass accusatory emotional positioning, posturing. And what I said to you in an exchange that you caught on to, and I'm glad you did, because I keep saying it, and you may be the first person who really got it. I said that to me, one of the most resonant feedback quotes I've gotten was from my good friend Stephen Erickson. He's in L.A. This was several weeks ago when it was all, we were well, several weeks into the lockdown and over quote-unquote coronavirus, and we were beginning to despair, and he texted me, "Celia, I feel like I'm in Jonestown." And, okay, why Jones? And I just went, wow, Stephen, that's it. You just said it. Because either you feel like we're in Jonestown, or you feel like the virus is the enemy, and they're just trying to protect us. I envy those people who feel that way and think that way about this whole situation, that there's a pathogen from China, which is irrelevant one way or the other. And the pathogen, it's the same thing they did with HIV. They take a commonly occurring human, I'm not going to say pathogen, because retroviruses are not were never pathogens before HIV, mm-hmm. and it's possible that retroviruses, as a class of viruses, and the whole retroviral phenomenon in humans is in fact a really sophisticated communication system in the human body. Mm-hmm. That is to say. Mm-hmm. Communicating at lightning speed the need for DNA repair. Mm-hmm. But let me get away from that. That's a whole other conversation. However, the important thing is to see how the military-industrial complex, for lack of a better term, this monster you invoke, okay, the economic monster, has to render evil human biology and flip it, turn it upside down and inside out, so that what is actually trying to help us in human biology is turned mm-hmm. into war and weaponry, war. And those things are not trying to kill us. It's those who are ascribing motive and process to those things, never telling us how or why they think the way they do, where is their evidence, where is the virus purified? Where is the gold standard against which a reasonable test can be designed? Where is Koch's postulates fulfilled? None of it. You just see the thing with the green knobs. You must submit to what something somewhere, no one scientist has ever fathered any of this, right? Nobody's saying, I purified it. Here's why I think it causes the disease. I will stand and fall on it. It just rolls out internationally, simultaneously, complete with everything ascribed to the pathogen that has never been proven. And the virus, it does this, it does that. So this virus craze, it's like a new way to, it's a new way to lose hope. It's a new way to wield accusation, to bludgeon, to bully. It serves so many nefarious, destructive purposes, and it takes us away from our humanity. So what we're in now, it begins with this, the way I see it, this breakdown of what it means to be human in the name of a virus that was never purified, never isolated, never proven to cause anything. I understand people got sick. I understand something's happening out there. But the most frightening thing to me is how this thing has come in and smashed up our intra-human web. How we are.
Yes, you have a kind of. I hear you. I just want to respond to what you're saying, because you see, it's sort of a. One has to remember the way in which Madison Avenue was really an extension of the Central Intelligence and related agencies, not merely Central Intelligence. People know about that. Things like the Congress for Cultural Freedom Project of the 1940s, ostensibly done to fight the war against communism, which didn't really need to be fought either. These things that were all done sort of in 45, 46, but then took on a life of their own, as these things are wont to do. It's important that everybody remember that until 1945, with the atomic bomb, there was no permanent mobilization of the military that occurred in American history. American military always demobilized. But with the use of the atomic weapon, with our dropping the two atomic bombs we had, we would have dropped more if we had them. But we used the two. And something occurs in which now you've got to have a permanent military process. But besides that, it's the bureaucracy that goes with it. Now what occurs is you begin to create a parallel governmental structure. But I referenced Madison Avenue, because the interesting thing about the intelligence agencies for us to consider is that they operated through advertising firms. Because why? Well, because you're trying to get a notion of how to manipulate and how to shape and how to pre-establish, for that matter, what people are going to wear, buy, and think 2, 3, 4 years into the future. And, of course, that was essentially the kind of thing that was being done on Madison Avenue. So let's come to the question of viruses, and not merely in all senses. It's sort of like, think about the virus like a hula hoop. You know, you're going to try to market this thing. You're trying to market this idea that, you know, you've got this new enemy, but you got to do it in such a fashion that it catches on. Russiagate, for example, was of that variety. There's not any actual, as Bill Binney, you've had him on your show, has stated. The problem involved with the so-called narrative is that it demands us to believe that computer processing speeds have nothing to do with whether or not Russia could have hacked the DNC without the knowledge of the NSA. that is to say, because that's what you got to believe. You got to believe that despite the fact that the National Security Agency has this globally extended network and it's intricate, it's been set up since 1947 and so forth and so on, and that they pick up literally the hint of a fart from any, signal from anything coming from outside the United States. Now, despite the fact of that, and despite the fact that the computer processing speeds, which were forensically tested by Bill Binney, who did this work for 30 years, okay, and was the leading code breaker for NSA, despite the fact he can't reproduce and his team can't reproduce anything remotely like the incident. Nonetheless, if you talk to, again, as they say, apparently intelligent people in the tens of millions in America, they will all tell you that this absolutely happened. No question it happened. There's no question that Trump is in the pocket of blah, blah, blah. They'll say that. So now what are we talking about? The intelligence agencies are not merely the people that put a gun to some president's head and kill him, or the kind of thing that people are familiar with the Mission Impossible series. No, as Bill Casey once said, at the point that, you know, people believe, you know, that at the point that 80% of what people believe is false, we will have won. That's the world that you're creating. So the Jonestown analogy you made, let's come back to this issue of viruses. You may remember there's an old story I would ask people to maybe take a look at, called by James Thurber. He used to work write for New Yorker. He was a humorist, very well known back in the 1950s and 60s and 40s. He wrote a story called The Day the Dam Broke. And basically what happens is it's a story about a little town in which there's a couple people, who one of whom is hard of hearing, and a couple of other who are still are hysterical. And essentially what happens is they have a little bit of an exchange, and they start talking about one topic, but it turns into another topic. So what happens is that though you start in one place, you end up in another place, and pretty soon the entire town believes that the dam has broken that guards the town, which is in a valley, and everybody starts running because the dam broke, but the dam didn't break. And as they run, right, the rumor gets worse and worse and bigger and bigger, and then sort of eventually somebody realizes that this has not occurred at all, and everybody sort of sheepishly goes back home and agrees not to talk about it. You're in a circumstance, and because of my association with Lyndon LaRouche, which of course we did want to get to, so I'll just bring it up, since that is a certain kind of third rail, particularly in New York City and a few other locations. I just bring this up because what LaRouche did with the Executive Intelligence Review magazine, which started in January of 74, so we're like deep into the period, you know, Vietnam War still going on. A lot of people are now beginning to find out about CIA and conspiracies, and, you know, the massacre at My Lai is exposed by Seymour Hersh, who thankfully is still with us and working on stories exactly like Russiagate. So it's an interesting time to be around. But it's also a time where a lot of despair has happened because there have been the assassinations, JFK, Malcolm X, RFK, Martin Luther King. And then they're killing kids at Kent State and at Jackson State. And so Weather Underground, ostensibly as a reaction to that, and they're doing bombings all over New York City. But, of course, really a lot of this is really being done by the FBI, and some of the people are real pro-terrorists, and some people are not, and there's Jane Alpert, and there's this and that, but there's a lot of different people in this. It's a time where people have lost the idea of community. No longer can you really expect to change the world by demonstrating. And a lot of different people talked about it at the time, and whether that was Patti Smith who talked about it, and how it was time to get, time to get out of the street, or whether it was, you know, Bonnie Raitt, who decided, hey, you know, I was in SDS, I tried and looked at this thing, but you know what, this is going nowhere, I'm going to go sing the blues. Whatever it was, people realized something had changed. There was no cohesion. And what happened with some of us, we were associated with Lyndon LaRouche, who later became, matter of fact, it was 74. He was now the cult leader, Lyndon LaRouche. because we were putting out things and writing articles and stating things, and we're just saying, wait a minute, maybe these things aren't all the way they seem to be. Maybe the left is not really the left and the right is not really the right. Maybe there is no left and right the way the people are talking about it. Maybe this stuff is being manipulated by a series of foundations and agencies and persons associated therewith. And maybe what's happening is that we're seeing a dissolution of the party system. And maybe what's actually happening is that we are going to, as an American population, whatever that is, and that may be in an institution or organization, or it may just be individuals. Maybe we got to actually figure this out for ourselves. Well, you mentioned Jonestown. Remember how that comes together. That's the People's Temple. That seems to be a political, but it's a church, and it's also political. They're very important in the getting out of the vote in the Democratic Party in California, particularly in San Francisco and a couple of other cities back there in 1976. And they're there with Jim Jones and various things. Well, without going through a whole story about Jonestown, the reason that the image is so compelling, and I thought was compelling when you brought it up, was because you had this 800-plus people, most of whom clearly intention of dying that day, who are told by this individual that they have trusted, you know, the world is now turned into a place which demands your exit. And if you look at today's America, if you look at the process that we're in, rather than looking at and trying to use Donald Trump as the whipping boy, as though we did not know who Donald Trump is a well-known person in New York City. The presidency of the United States is not the same thing. He's there. There's immense power in this position, usually manipulated, particularly since 9/11. And here we are in a world where we've got to, when you look at the 50 million people now unemployed in the United States, you look at the 272 million people who are living in some other country because they went to another country to get work, whether they're Turkish people in Germany or there are Mexicans in the United States, or you just look around the world. There's 272 million people doing that, and 800 million other people depend on them for what are called remittances, them sending money back home. That's what Amadou Diallo was doing from up in the Bronx. When he got shot 41 times, he's Senegalese. He's sending money back home to try to help the little town he came from. And so when you consider, then look at the immigrant crisis, all these other things we could talk about. And now, of course, this coronavirus phenomenon. When you look at these things and you look at the political institutions, you look at the Democratic Party's Joe Biden, and you look at the problems of what we see in day-to-day life in America, is it really wise to keep focusing in this weird way on what you think or don't think about Donald Trump? Can that possibly be a healthy pastime, or is that a form of a pathology, a form of social virus, in which once again we talk about an apocryphal source of all evil, which we're supposed to point to even as we sink into the quicksand of our own intellectual and emotional inertia?
Well, you know, what just came up in my mind is, well, it's kind of obvious. 2 minutes hate in George Orwell's 1984. It was very important for that dystopic totalitarian society that he painted for us, that one man was the very, very bad man, Emmanuel Goldstein, and that all the people went in every day and hated on him and threw tomatoes at the screen and screamed. And that's an interesting idea that Orwell gave us, almost like an enigma. Why is it important for totalitarians to do that, to give the people this one hated figure, right? And boy, has it been successful. You can't get anybody off the subject. They're monomaniacally obsessed with his persona, his supposed evil, what he's doing, and they, and it's almost like a mass psychosis of masochism, that he has such power to destroy all of our lives and all of our hopes and all, and it's absolutely, it has distorted so much that sometimes I despair. Well, like all of us, you know, you just, you stop talking to friends because there it is. There it is. And you can't explain, like the Who song, I can't explain. And I interviewed Pete Townsend about many things, including that song. And he said, the song is about the feeling. I can't explain what I can't explain. And that's this kind of slipping desperation that I get. And I feel like I'm sentenced to solitary confinement in the end. If I don't.
Yeah, I think this I hear you.
If I don't see what my friends are seeing, and I don't, but I see all kinds of other stuff that they're not seeing. How does this happen that we're seeing such different things? It's like with the movie theaters. I'm at this movie theater. My friends are at the movie theater down the hall. You know, incredible, incredible trance magic cast on.
Yeah. Now we got to get people out of this. See, that's the point. We have to do. And I now, of course, you already said, and the people at the LaRouche Political Action Committee, I included, we started something because we're looking at a pathway out. What do we mean by that? If you look at the United States, see, let's remember, real nations with real people, almost 8 billion of us on the planet, have real economies. And if you look at the things like the George Floyd matter, and you look at the other any number of things, whether it's Khalif Barber, Sandra Bland, you can take any number of these. Some of them, many of them will be black, some of them will be Hispanic, so forth and so on. But they'll almost always come from neighborhoods or economies, right, which are paralyzed, circumstances which are dead ended. I'm saying this for the following reason. The idea is that you have 50 million people now in the United States, I mean, acknowledged, there may be actually even more, who've been put on hold, put into a form of solitary or certainly imprisonment. They may not be solitary confinement, but imprisonment. What are they going to go back to? You know, a lot of young people, of course, who dropped out of the workforce anyway, say, well, you know, actually, I don't know what the purpose of all this is. What's the purpose of college, these other things? And if you contrast it, that's an American feeling. But if you take a nation like China, people will say, oh, yeah, China. Wait a minute. But they have taken 800 million people out of poverty. Take Vietnam, which is right next door to China, right? I mean, of course, they fought the Chinese for 2,000 years. How many cases of coronavirus are there in Vietnam? I just invite people to go check it out. I'll just tell you there are very, very few. They're right next door. That's the old time Vietnam, which we napalmed the hell out of, right? Killed 2 million people. Well, you realize that actually I think about 70% or more of the Vietnamese population don't remember that war. It's a very young country, first of all, but actually don't particularly have the view that you would expect. They have a completely different perception than one would assume. So here's what I'm going to say. Here's what we can do. You have to realize that the wretched of the earth, the dispossessed, and in our country there's 100 million of those people, I would say, that the dispossessed are the only solution, the only way out of our circumstance. And that's not because they're going to be wretched of the earth and they're going to be marching and whatever. That's not what I mean. Donald Trump or any other president of the United States has a choice to look at the United States the way that Franklin Roosevelt looked at the United States. He saw a United States in which one-third of the population was ill-housed, ill-clothed, and ill-fed, as he said in 1936. And in 1933, when he came in and he gave that first inaugural, the famous, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror
which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance. That's a statement. That's what you're dealing with in America, fear itself. And the problem involved is we who know something about both the history of that time and also the power that the United States really has, because the United States has 1 million farmers right now that are producing 1% of the food. It's got these giant cooperatives that are killing us with all kinds of things, the Monsantos and so forth, quasi-food. And you got these million farmers who will be prepared to actually produce real food at real prices at some kind of parity, which would not be more expensive for the American people, far less expensive. You wouldn't be importing junk or food that rots or food that you have to preserve in weird ways. You know, you'd have the old kind of truck farmer you had out in Long Island. Some people remember it, or Southern Jersey. That's only one example. Then the infrastructure of our country. I could go on and on. You would just take the things that Roosevelt did with the New Deal. And I don't mean the Green New Deal. I'm talking about something where real people with real productive jobs, the one-third of our country that has been forgotten ever since 1980 with the so-called post-industrial society and information technology is going to come in, and one-third of our country was cut out, never to be cut back in. If this president or any president or any group of people, just us, if we start addressing that reality, I'll tell you what will happen. What will happen is that the falsehoods, the false perceptions, the weirdness, the weird fights and contradictions you find yourself in with people that you didn't even try, you weren't looking for it. You were just talking, and all of a sudden you run into this cul-de-sac that you didn't know was there in your communication with people that you've known your whole life. This, our problem is that the solution is always with the dispossessed, in the sense that if you address that circumstance and you address it as a nation, then that paralyzing fear, that unjustified terror, cannot live in the heart, because your heart is extended to those and to not just quote improving the lives. It's not just that. It's improving the nation, changing us as us. So we are doing something together. And because we're doing something together, this kind of fear can't divide us. That's what we got to do, I think.
Dennis, I want to ask you this. There's a video clip going around. I saw it, one of many heartbreaking clips. Rioters set fire to a homeless man's only earthly possession, starting with his mattress. And forgive me, I can't recall which city this was in. Alex Jones of InfoWars was falsely accused of having started this fire, but you can see on the clip that it's, I would say, an Antifa person dressed exactly like that and with that exact, mm-hmm. you know, persona. And the man stands up and he just screams right out, "No, no." And he says, "I live here. I live here. Why would you do this?" And we've heard this cry from so many, you know, "Why would you destroy my store? I worked my whole life for this." So what comes to me is, wow, with activists like this destroying all hope for the dispossessed, who are they really working for? Can you just tell me, what do you think about Antifa? And I don't know if we have time to get into Black Lives Matter, but they don't seem like any activists I've ever seen. They seem, all right, I'll be quiet. Never mind what I think.
No, you asked me what I think. I'll do a real, I mean, it depends. I mean, what's our time like? Because I'm good, but how are you?
I'm unrealistic about time always, but on this show, I have to be realistic. We have 5 minutes.
Okay, great.
But
so Dennis,
this is just our first conversation. You must come back. Okay, go ahead.
All right, great. Beautiful. We're dealing with Anthony Burgess's A Clockwork Orange. That's what we're dealing with.
Bingo.
Remember that the term Clockwork Orange is what does it mean? It refers to the idea, you know, you think of like a clockwork pigeon, or, you know, like if you think about one of those big clocks in Europe, you know, and it chimes and, you know, all the figures come out and they turn around. Okay, but a clockwork orange, what did it mean? What was the term to mean? It meant that it should be juicy, it should be sweet, but instead it's got a mechanism inside of it. You asked me about Antifa. You asked me about Black Lives Matter. These things are synthetic. They're creations. Some people have talked about it. Other people who are rappers and some other people have talked about it. And remember, Antifa is Antifa. It's really originally a German-based, a European-based, and also particularly largely active in Germany from the period of the late 80s, early 90s. So it's not an American phenomenon. But more importantly, the image you gave of the homeless man being assaulted by the rioters is Alex and his friends in a Clockwork Orange beating up the homeless man. But they're revolutionaries, right? So that's what you're seeing. What's being given to us, and this is the thing that we can all walk away from, are synthetic movements with you know, powered by, you know, iPhones and all this, and is imagery, which is supposed to overwhelm the reason. So now it becomes like an advertising, right? Remember what Edward Bernays says. The whole point is to get people away from the idea of what's functional to what makes them feel a certain way. And it doesn't necessarily just be it feels good. It can make you feel bad. It can make you feel needy. It can make you feel fearful. It's feeling. And so reason's not attached. So what you have, and I believe what we have to say here, is clearly there was an injustice. It was monstrous what was done. People want to express themselves. Yes, but you better find a different way. Gotcha. You got to find a different way to do it. And I think this conversation and this idea of thinking about tragedy or reading tragedy and beginning to see oneself not in the tragic figures, so to speak, but the notion that the tragedy is in us. It's us reversing our axioms, thinking not just outside of the box, realizing there never was a box.
That's right. That's right. I'm so glad you brought up Burgess, Clockwork Orange. When I cite which novel are we in, people always say 1984. Yes, of course. Brave New World. Yes, of course. We're also in A Clockwork Orange and Lord of the Flies by William Golding. And this is the plague to me, is this heartlessness, this extreme heroic heartlessness, which for the life of me, I cannot get on board with. I cannot understand. It terrifies me. But I'm so grateful and heartened to have had this conversation with you. Dennis, you've given me hope. I'm going to throw my shoulders back and carry on. And we didn't quite get to the matter of what people can do. But Dennis, let me ask you point blank. Will you come back and talk to me, possibly both of us, when Christina comes back again soon?
Be happy to do so.
Fantastic, because I feel like we did it. We brought the conversation outside of the burning tar ball. And I know that there are so many people who are desperate to join in on this conversation with us, because this is the real American heart and spirit that we're talking about right here. Dennis Speed, thank you so much. We will be back next week. I'm Celia Farber. You've been listening to The Whistleblower.